Hey, this is Hojo, and you're listening to me on Baseball and Barbecue with my two best friends, my new best friends, Jeff and Leonard. So y'all enjoy it, okay?
Studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 229. I'm Jeff Theo Cohen, along with Leo Hollywood Averin, and we welcome you back to our show. Well, hey, Leo, how you doing?
So glad to be here. What a quick turnaround. You know, for those of you who are not aware, we released a bonus episode in the middle of this week. So, you know, everybody's like, well, I get my episode, you know, Saturday, day of the week. Bonus episode, we release Wednesday. So make sure you check that out. It's a good one.
Yes. And this is a good one too.
Yeah. Who do we have on the show?
We have the former manager of the year for the Colorado Rockies, Clint Hurdle, who took the team to the World Series. He's also the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates and got them into the playoffs after a 20-year layoff.
Yeah, he is a phenomenal manager. I know I said something like you're a fantastic manager. He's really took two teams that you didn't expect to go anywhere, took them places. And we also have Matt Deaton for barbecue, along with Chef Ray. That's Ray Sheehan. So we've got Clint Hurdle, Matt Deaton, Ray Sheehan, and we've got Bet Online, which continues to be your number one source for all your basketball wagering needs, including pro and college hoops throughout the year. With up-to-the-minute odds, stats, and trends, you could follow your favorite team's path to the playoffs with in-game live betting, contests, and all the best player props. Experience the world's best wagering platform anytime from your desktop or your mobile devices. Head to BetOnline today to become part of the team. And remember to use promo code BLEAV. That's BLEAV for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. You ready for this? BetOnline. It is where the game starts.
Well, Leonard, how you doing?
I'm so excited, Jeff, because we rarely get to speak to a major league manager. There aren't many of them. If your kid one day says, you ask him, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he says, a major league manager. That's a toughie. Do you talk him out of that? since there are only 30 of them, that might be a problem. So we speak to Clint Hurdle, and that's exciting. And by the way, after Clint, we have a listener who has a pet peeve.
Oh, can't wait for that.
You can't, absolutely. So, Jeff, bring in our guest.
And here is the great manager of the Colorado Rockies and the Pittsburgh Pirates and coaches along the way, Clint Hurdle. We are so excited to have with us the 2013 National League Manager of the Year. He was the 9th overall selection in the 1975 Major League Baseball draft and signed by the Kansas City Royals. In addition to playing for the Royals, he played for the Reds, Mets, and Cardinals. After his playing career, he went into coaching and managing, leading the Colorado Rockies to the 2007 World Series. After his time in Colorado, he led the Pirates to 3 straight playoff appearances after 20 years of missing the postseason. We are so happy to have with us Clint Hurdle. Welcome, Clint.
Welcome, Clint.
Thanks for having me, guys.
I want to start with your career as a player, but I almost want to ask you more about your career as a manager, because I think you would probably agree your managerial career was incredible. Well, maybe you wouldn't call it incredible, but it was darn good.
There's times I think my career felt like an obstacle course, and my my managerial career seemed to have just a little smoother transition and tenure to it. I just had this conversation the other day, and I really think that I believe this, guys. I believe we're prepared for our future through our past if we've paid attention. And I think I was fortunate enough that I paid just enough attention through my playing career that it really helped me once I became a coach and then I stepped into the managerial box. Just a lot of experiences to draw from. A lot of highs, a lot of lows, and a lot of things in between. There wasn't much that any player or coach could bring to me in my office that I probably hadn't experienced personally, and or I didn't know of somebody that I could reach out to help them with their situation.
And also, Clint, you know, talking about your playing career, you were the Sports Illustrated cover boy, and they called you a phenom. Tell us, well, what is it? What is the experience of being on the cover of Sports Illustrated?
Well, it's a lot, and there's nothing that can actually prepare you for it. I don't know how much experience, you know, hopefully some of the listeners know some things about Sports Illustrated other than the fact that it's going to be taken off the shelves here soon.
Yeah, it's sad.
It is sad. It was a magazine that I would thought could defy the test of time, and just goes to show you how much I know. But there was a time, I want to say it was almost a 3 or 4 year run, in which every spring training, Sports Illustrated christened some young player with the label phenom. I can't remember who the first, I think Harry Chapis, second baseman shortstop for the White Sox, may have been the year before me, and then it was me. And to be put on the cover of a national magazine, number one, to have a title like Unlimited Potential, this year's phenom, that's a lot. I don't know if anybody could even handle that if that was your title at your desk. You know, I was given one of these in Pittsburgh. I think you can see it a little bit with the glare, but can you imagine Unlimited Potential and this year's phenom on your desk monitor? You know, they never let anybody know who was going to be on the cover ahead of time. So that particular spring, I think they had filmed maybe 24 other young players. There was another guy in our camp they filmed with me that day, Willie Wilson. Turned out to have a very long established major league career. Very good player.
Very good player, yeah.
But we went through an hour and a half of filming, almost to the point where it's like, what more can you possibly film? And then they said, that's it. You know, the cover is going to come out in a couple of weeks. Maybe you'll be in it. And actually, they ended up, I think, talking about maybe 8 to 10 other guys. Jim Wright, who happened to be one of my pitching coaches later on. He was a big right-hander with the Phillies had. Mike Cox, third baseman, since passed the Red Sox. Willie Wilson was there, but a few other guys. But I can remember the day that I went to my local stop on the way into spring training. It was a 7-Eleven. I stopped the same place every day. And I grabbed my breakfast of champions, which was a honey bun and a quart of milk. You guys can remember what a honey bun was?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of course. Yes.
Like 3 pounds of dough with sugar. So I can remember going up, seeing the guy my age, same guy at the counter every morning. I put the honey bun down. I put the milk down. Now, 7-Eleven back in the day carried 3 magazines, and they didn't have a magazine rack. They had the 3 magazines, and they were on the counter. It was Time, Newsweek, and Sports Illustrated. So I'd always look at the Time. I'd look at the Newsweek, and I'd look at the Sports Illustrated. You know, it beats what you do today when you go through the grocery lane and the different magazines that are up. You know, you have so many options, you can get confused. But you had the 3, and I can remember putting my things down, and then the young man looked at me, and he looked down at the magazines, and he looked back at me. He looked back at the magazines. He looked at me. So I looked at the magazines. I saw Time, Newsweek, and then I saw me. And I looked at him. He looked at me. No words were spoken, and I walked out. Without the honey bun, without the quart of milk. And truthfully, guys, it was a lot. I went to practice that day, and, you know, there's men in that clubhouse. Back in the day, you wouldn't carry the numbers they're carrying now, 65, 70 people in spring training. You might have 40, you might have 50. But there was men in there 30, 35 years old that never been on the cover of a magazine their whole life. And here comes this 20-year-old kid that's done nothing at the major league level, and he's on the cover of a magazine. So it obviously evoked a lot of emotions from a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. And then there was the part that, you know, even subliminally, I do believe that it got put me in a place where I felt like, okay, you really got to do something special now, where I never, ever tried to do anything special in ball field. I just play ball. And now I started figuring out how I should quantify the way I was going to play ball. It didn't help, but I learned a lot of valuable lessons through it. And it tested me in a lot of different ways. And I think it was another part of the branding that I needed to go through to become a major league manager and to understand what other high picks, you know, that are chosen, what they go through, and I can relate to a little more sensibly.
Yeah, those high picks back then in the 70s and even through today, I mean, are there unrealistic expectations put on them?
Well, you know, there may have been, but I think there's unrealistic expectations put on people today. I don't think it's changed at all. I think a lot of things in society are pretty much in sync. I just know you're prepared a lot differently today. You know, they have programs that these young players, your high draft choices, have just been drafted to go through. It's like a rookie prep class, or what you're going to expect your rookie season. A lot of these kids in college are going into the draft, get prepped before the draft. Where they could be taken. And, you know, the media responsibility, their awareness, social media, do's and don'ts, just public perception, what you're in control of, what you're not in control of. So I think there's a lot more awareness and preparation of what's in front of them. However, you know, it was what it was back then. You don't know any different because you don't know what you don't know. Right. We had our sports information director, our PR guy. He did the best he could with the requests, and there was a lot of them. And I think the other thing young guys can get hung up and women can get hung up into, and a lot is expected of you. If you sit down for a press conference and there's 20 people and everybody asks a question, you've got to answer every question. You know, there is a time when it can come off like you're a know-it-all at the end because you're answering all these questions that people have. It's not that you think you're a know-it-all. You're just trying to take care of what's being asked of you. And if your performance doesn't match up to the perception, that's where it can get a little slippery.
Yeah. Your time in Kansas City, you played for Whitey Herzog when you started out there. You had a very good year in 1980, I believe. Yep, 80. And actually, 78, you had a pretty good year, too. How was your time in Kansas City? And did you sample any of the barbecue out there?
Well, yes and yes. I love my time in Kansas City. It's kind of like maybe the first girl you fall in love with. I think you'll always remember her name. Kansas City was my first big league club. Mm-hmm. It was my first opening day. It was my first major league at bat. Whitey was my first major league manager. The teammates I had, my locker was next to Amos Otis. George Brett was on that team. Hal McRae, Splitorf, Dennis Leonard. Freddie Pawtek was the shortstop my rookie year. Frank White. So, you know, you go from being a young kid in AAA, now you're in a grown man's room. And the Royals were an exciting team at that time. They were a very exciting team at that time.
Yeah.
We drew 3 million fans. We played AstroTurf. We played a fast-paced brand of baseball. We pitched it. We caught it. And, we hit the ball. We got out of the box. Whitey was a very aggressive manager. He put a lot of things in play that are still in play today with platoon systems, leveraging the bullpen. But it was a lot of fun. It definitely was a lot of fun. There was a lot to learn. I've always enjoyed going back to Royal Stadium. Obviously, it's been redecorated 2 or 3 times. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
The fans were fantastic. And the barbecue at that time, as good as it is now, it may have been better then because you didn't have as many. You know, it's kind of like if you go to a major league spring training now, there's 20 different bat companies bringing bat. So do you really think all 20 have the best wood? I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm sorry. I don't think so. But back in the day, you might have had 3 or 4 bat carriers. You had Rawlings, you had Rawlings, and then you had Louisville Slugger,
right,
and maybe one other one. Mizuno maybe just popped on the scene. But barbecue back in that day, there was 4 or 5 joints. Gates was one of them, but the place, uh-huh, no doubt, you talked to me from Kansas City, was Arthur Bryant's barbecue.
Yep.
Arthur Bryant's barbecue. Arthur was so good at barbecue that he didn't even put tables and chairs inside his restaurant. You came in, you got in line, you grabbed food and you went. there were a few tables outside to sit at, but it was like a cash cow, the turnstile for people coming in. And the best tribute, one of the best tributes I've ever seen, a local cartoonist there, a good friend of mine for many, many years, Lee Judge, he was the cartoonist for the Kansas City Star. When Arthur passed, on the front page of the Kansas City Star was a picture of Arthur at the pearly gates, and it shows a godlike figure person behind the gates opening them and said, "Arthur, did you bring the sauce?" That puts it all in perspective.
Yeah. Len and I had the pleasure of eating at Arthur Bryant's recently. And, you know, I'm sure it's very good today. Must have been much better back then, though. You know, in your very first game, I believe you hit a home run, didn't you? Your first hit was a home run.
Well, my second hit was a home run.
Oh, your second hit was a home run. Okay.
But this was a story I got a friend of mine who's documenting first at bats for different players in the big leagues, because you only get one.
Right.
And everybody's story is their own story. It's a testimonial of someone. My first at bat to set up my second at bat was really yuck. I had just come off an MVP season in AAA. I had a very good year offensively. Was up in the big leagues. Most of the other guys played. UL Washington, Willie Wilson, Rich Gale. They all performed in front of me. Finally got my opportunity. As I'm going up for my first at bat, Charlie Lau, the iconic hitting coach, pulls me aside and says, "Hey, Clint, you're going to be nervous, a lot of adrenaline. Take the first pitch. Just take it." I'm like, "Charlie, what?" He goes, "Clint, trust me. Take the first pitch." "Okay, Charlie, I'm going to take the first pitch." Glenn Abbott's on the mound, big right-hander for the Mariners. He lets it go, and I can see the ball, and it's one of those few times in your life. The ball's big. The ball's really big. The ball's right in the middle of the plate. The ball's very hittable. So there's a little guy on my shoulder said, "You need to hit this." And I think I said, "Charlie said, take a pitch, hit it, take a pitch." Anyway, check swing, ball off the barrel, two hopper to third. Guy I worked out with all winter, Billy Stein, who was a longtime utility player, good baseball player, 15-year vet. Two hopper to Billy Stein, who I worked with all winter in Rockledge, Florida, Maryland, Florida. Catches the grounder, throws it to first. I'm out by 15 feet. Hmm. Brutal.
Yeah.
Come back to the dugout. Oh, man, are they hooting and hollering. I'm getting made fun of. They're giving me the business. It's crazy bad. Charlie gives me one of these. I go over, sit next to Charlie. He goes, I thought we had agreed to take the first pitch. I say, "Yeah, Charlie, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, you were right." So he goes, "Okay, next at bat." And I go, "I'll take the first pitch, I promise." He goes, "No, that didn't work out very well for us." It's the next time you go up there, see something you like, and put a good swing on. So the next time I got up, I hit a two-run homer that still could probably be the longest homer I hit in my career. Unfortunately, it was my first one. It hit the second tier on the waterfalls. There's three walls. It used to be the old days. Three walls for the waterfalls. It hit on top of the second, bounced out of the stadium.
Wow.
To this day, I don't know if I got a ball that was my home run or some old man just picked the ball up in the parking lot, rubbed it on the gravel to scratch it up a little bit, and then brought it in. And we gave him a glove, a hat, a bat, or something for what was supposedly my home run ball.
Right.
You know, Clint, a lot of times now, or over the years, player will be at one position, perhaps catcher, and they'll say, "Oh, they could play the outfield or they could play first base." And it's not so easy and it doesn't work out. And yet you changed positions. You were invaluable because of your ability to learn a new position within a season even. What do you attribute that to? I mean, you must be some athlete.
Well, there probably was some athleticism involved. There's also some survival instincts that take place at certain times in your career. The one that was the biggest shocker, though, was with 2 weeks to go in spring training in 1978, the Royals traded John Mayberry to the Blue Jays and brought me in the office and said, "Hey, I think we're better served with the outfielder staying the way it was and you moving to first place and taking care of John's position." 20-year-old kid. What am I going to tell him? I said, "Yeah, whatever you want." I had never played first base in my life, not one inning of one game. I played a little third in high school. I played outfield all my career, right field through the minor leagues. Played a little, you know, that was it. I was one position, really. It was a bat and a right fielder with a strong arm. And then it was learned how to play first base with 2 weeks to go in the season. It was a lot. And through different roster challenges or situations, I moved to left field when I was in Kansas City. And, you know, that wasn't as hard because it's the outfield. However, the ball does come off the bat a different way. And then when I went to when I moved on a little bit further, Davey Johnson had the vision to move me to third base in AAA. Went after a few years in the big leagues, I learned how to play third base. And then the next year, he encouraged me to learn how to catch. At 27 years old, I became a catcher. And I actually pulled it off well enough to have caught close to 30 games in the big leagues. I caught Darling. I caught Fernandez. I caught Doc. I caught Tudor. I caught Forsh. I caught some of the guys in St. Louis and the Mets those 2 years I was catching. The most interesting part of it was I think the catching position was the one that opened my mind up to the vision of how the ball game really should look like. Because it's the only position you're behind the plate. You're looking at everybody else. Everybody else is looking in. And I really believe that was a vital piece of my experience needed to become the best manager that I could become, was understanding the importance of the starting rotation, the importance of, you know, leveraging, using a bullpen, the importance of the pitcher-catcher relationship, the importance of pitch sequencing, pitch calling. Those were things I really didn't have a whole lot of experience with in playing the corner positions that I had played before.
And, you know, Len, Flynn played for the 1985 New York Mets and 1987 New York Mets. 86, you're in St. Louis.
Well, that's another funny story because it got to be the point wherever I showed up in spring training, the guys would throw their hands and go, okay, we're going to finish second. Hurdles here. Because as you just stated, 85, I'm with the Mets. The Cardinals win. 86, I go to the Cardinals. The Mets win. 87, I go back. I go back to the Mets and the Cardinals win.
Yeah.
Missed it by that much. That was Maxwell Smart used to say. I missed it by that much.
That's right. Yeah. But you did talk about how it helped you become a manager, and you had some transition into managing, and you started in the New York Mets system. Where did you start? At low A or
a high A?
High A?
Right, Clint?
Yep, that is correct. And this, again, you know, the one thing I've noticed since I stopped managing in 2019 and I took 2 years off, I actually retired for 2 years, and then the Rockies came back to me and offered me a position that just made too much sense to not get back involved. I've got a lot of stories.
Yeah.
The one with the Mets, to become a manager of the Mets at the age of 30 was a very interesting sequence of events, because I had a guy that I'd already had some experience with, Davey Johnson, but Steve Scriver was running the Mets minor league system, the player development system. And he had seen me battle my last couple of years. I went into camp as a non-roster player. I made both rosters. I got more big league time. And he called me up that way and goes, hey, how many offers you got in the big league camp? I said, I've got one, Steve. That's with the Mets. And he said, well, it may be time you start thinking about what's next. And I go, well, what do you mean what's next? He goes, well, maybe coaching, managing. He goes, I really think that with the experiences you had, the 10 years in the big leagues, and all your stories and all your history, you could be an incredible leader of young men and manage young men in our player development system. I said, Steve, I'm very humble. I appreciate you thinking that highly of me. He goes, yeah, and I'd like you to think about it this year. That may be a little quicker than I anticipated. Okay. I said, so what are you talking about? He goes, well, how about if we start you in our low rookie program? And I'm not sure where that might have been. Maybe it was, I think it was Little Falls, New York, or there's someplace up in New York at the time, was low rookie. And I go, wow, okay, that's far away. I go, you're just building that place in St. Lucie for the new spring training site and the A-ball team, right? He goes, yeah, we are. But he goes, Florida State League, that's our fourth step up. You're not ready for that. You don't have the experience to manage that high. I said, well, you just said I got 10 years of major league experience. What do you need to manage high A-ball? You know, what is it you need? He goes, well, you need managerial experience. I go, okay, I'm going to pass on the managerial opportunity in Little Falls. I'm going to go back and I'm going to try and play. And he's had some things to say. He disagreed with my thought process. We hung up the phone. He calls me a week later and says, hey, something's happened. We have a managerial position open in high rookie. And maybe that was in Kingsport at the time. And I said, wow, well, I appreciate the bump up. At least you're thinking that way. He goes, well, yeah, I think you can pull this off. I go, well, have you filled the spot in St. Lucie? He goes, no, we haven't. I go, that's really the only one I have any interest in. And he told me again all the reasons why I wasn't qualified for that job. And I hung up. And then he called me right back. He goes, by the way, you realize you only have one spot invitation to spring training, right? I go, no, I don't. By the way, I have two. The Cardinals came back. So I get to decide whether it's you or the Cardinals I go to spring training with. So, you know, I think I'm leveraging my opportunity, right? I have two teams out of however many. And he calls me a week later and he goes, okay, enough of this nonsense. He said, you're going to try and go to non-roster, make a team. He said, if I was able to put you in place in St. Lucie, would you retire and start managing? And I said, well, Steve, first of all, this is the best conversation we've had so far. I said, players like me don't retire, Steve. We play until people don't call us anymore. That's not retiring. So this would be a much better transition in my mind. I could walk from one to the other. It's 35, 40 minutes from my house. Spring training the whole year there. That's a pretty smooth transition. And I think I can pull it off. Well, we ended up doing a deal, and that's where I started at Port St. Lucie in the Florida State League. But it is kind of ironic that I ended up getting a higher position because I kept threatening my player development director with playing. Going back and playing.
Smart. So how long were you managing the Mets system before getting a managing gig? Or did you coach first for the Rangers before getting the managing gig?
No, I managed 2 years at each level in the Mets organization.
Okay.
2 years at St. Lucie, a year at Jackson. We were supposed to move to Binghamton. They had a bad winter. We couldn't get in Binghamton on time. That was a delay. We went to Williamsport. Then I managed the last year at Tidewater Park in Norfolk, and the first year at Harbor Park, which is the new facility built then. Mm-hmm. From there, I was fired by the Mets. Steve Phillips and I, we went through a period where we couldn't agree on anything. Mm-hmm. Steve and I, by the way, are really good friends now.
Right.
At the time, we weren't good friends at all. I think he said, you know, I said, well, I'm going to quit before you fire me. He goes, no, I've already fired you. You can't quit. It was one of those guy conversations.
Right.
But then I went to Colorado and became the minor league hitting coordinator. Dick Balderson was running the player development program. He's a guy I knew from my days with the Royals. So Dick Balderson was actually the only person I knew in the Rockies organization. Anybody. I didn't know a player. I didn't know a coach. He brought me as the minor league hitting coordinator. I did that job from 93, the winter, started in Strux Lake, 94, 95, 96, and 97. Don Baylor took me on board as his hitting coach, first base coach, and outfield coach. So can you imagine 31 years ago, I was a coach that had three job descriptions where they have three different coaches do those three different things now.
Right.
But Don Baylor, of all people, brought me in, and that was such a boost to my confidence. A good, solid baseball man.
Mm-hmm.
A man with presence, a man with guts, with integrity. A lot of things chose me to be on his coaching staff, especially as his hitting coach. And that actually, I think, put me in my best self-esteem and self-confidence that I've had. Not cocky by any means, but it just made me feel that I was worthy. I was more than worthy for Don Baylor to tap me to be his guy.
Now, Flint, when you became the manager of the Rockies, there's a few things I want to know about Colorado, but this kind of goes together because you now have Larry Walker and Todd Helton, who are Hall of Famers, played for you, and with the people that don't vote for them, you always hear, oh, well, in Colorado, you know, the ball travels, it's, you know, a hitter's park and all that. I'd like to hear what you have to say about Colorado, the stadium and those comments, and then what it was like to manage two Hall of Famers like Walker and Helton.
Well, I think still to this day, I've probably watched more games in the Rockies dugout than anybody else. 5 years as a hitting coach, almost 8 years as a manager. I've seen a lot. Yes, it's a hitter-friendly ballpark. However, there's also challenges that come with playing every day in Colorado that challenge you physically because of the sense you're playing defense at altitude. You're running the bases at altitude. Your physical exertion throughout the entire game at altitude. You can make it a competitive advantage for sure as a home team. However, there's the other side to it, which nobody talks about. You're never out of a game in Colorado. You don't think you're ever out of a game. So there's games in certain other places. You get behind, the manager clears the bench. you know, or he takes some guys out, they get a rest. Very rarely does that happen in Colorado, especially back in the day when we had offensively structured, really, really good teams. That it wasn't a big thing to be down 8-1 after five. I mean, it was doable. It was doable, real doable. So your guys are always mentally in the game. They're staying in the game physically. They're always working. And truth be told, our guys used to love going to a handful of other parks that were just easy to hit. Come on. I mean, Camden Yards? Nobody talks about Camden Yards.
Yeah, that's at Hedges Park.
Yeah. I mean, nobody talks about Wrigley Field. Yeah, when the wind's blowing in, yeah, there's days you can't hit it out. There's days that you can pick it and hit it out at Wrigley Field. So there was multiple parks throughout Lake Houston. How about the ballpark there to left field now? I mean, the conversations are so one-sided. And basically, I think the people that jump on that thought, it's because they really don't know. They haven't been there. And they can't even open up their vision to talk about how homer-friendly are some of these other parks. Because every year you can find out where the most homers are hit. And it's not Coors Field every year.
Right.
That being said, they're both in. It took Larry a lot longer than I anticipated, but he got in and Helton's in. And I think Larry may have been the most strongest tool set of any player ever had. Five complete tools. He was a five-tool guy. And, you know, one thing when I say that, I never want to not give credit to the players about honing their craft and becoming master craftsmen. It's not like Larry just woke up and became a five-tool player. There's a story in A-ball. Ken Brett was managing the team. Gene Glenn, who was one of coaching with me in Colorado for a number of years. Larry Walker wasn't good enough to make the West Palm Beach Expos team in A-ball. He played on a co-op team that year up in the New York Penn League. And he was on first base. Somebody hit a deep drive to right. He ran first to third. It was a hit and runner. He was stealing. He ran all the way to third. The guy caught the ball. Ken Brett said, "You got to go back to first." He was coaching third. Larry ran directly across the infield, right by the pitcher's mound, slid into first. The umpire called him out. He argued because he had beat the throw. Really no understanding of the rules. No reach tracing his steps. No coming back to second. He just ran straight across the infield. So Larry worked hard at his game. He worked hard. You know, I think he's the one player that I've heard people say you can't teach instincts. No, players can teach themselves instincts. And if you got some good coaches along the way, I think you can help that whole instinct package out, because Larry had hockey instincts. He had a passion for hockey, and he became a very, very good baseball player, a feared hitter, feared defender, great on the bases. Todd Helton may have been the fiercest competitor and the best overall hitter that I've ever seen. Todd Helton would rather give up a small body part than give away an at bat. And obviously, I had a lot of people call the last month and talk about Todd Helton experiences, funny stories, whatever have you. And they would say, you know, he never looked like he was happy on the field. I said, well, he was happy on the field. He didn't play the baseball like Miguel Cabrera plays baseball. Big, jovial, always a smile. I said, Helton derived his joy from beating your ass on the baseball field. That's how he got his joy. Just understand that. And then you'll understand Todd Helton. They were both, and it's so cool, they're both going in as Rockies. And it's been, I just think it adds street cred to the organization, adds street cred to the ballpark and what those two men accomplished.
Yeah. You know, Len, I don't know if Clint knows this, but he also managed the newest member of the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame, and it's Todd Zeal. Did you know he went into the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame?
I had heard that, or I saw it somewhere a little while ago, and well-deserved. Todd was a very good player, a very smart player. He had gifts. He came to us at a good time for us. He wasn't a locker room statesman. He was just a voice of reason. And he got raised playing baseball the Cardinal way. There was a lot of good in that. He has a very witty sense of humor. He was in a good place in his career. He wanted to play. And I can remember one time I actually gave him his first opportunity to pitch in the big leagues as well. He pitched one of those mop-up innings you have every once in a while, unfortunately. Sure. But he did that, and he busted out a knuckleball. And Bobby Baylor was the last position player I knew of that could throw a knuckleball off the mound. But Todd Zeal, and I think it was a scoreless inning. I mean, you guys can check on that at a later date. But, yeah, he pitched a good relationship. I learned a lot from him. It was a pleasure having him on our team.
Now, you're the manager of Colorado. You take him to a World Series. And then I don't know what happened. You must have forgotten everything, because all of a sudden you're a great manager. You're not a great manager. It's I can only imagine what it's like to be in that position. But you go to Texas and you worked with Josh Hamilton, who had one of his best seasons as a member of the Texas Rangers. What was it like to be with Josh Hamilton?
Well, you guys live in that world where the outside narrative very rarely does it match up to the inside narrative. And I think anybody that gets into a position of a head coach or a manager realizes that not many times do you decide when you walk away or how you walk out. So we went to a World Series 14 months later. They threw a parade. You know, of course, when we got home, we didn't win, but they threw a parade. 14 months later, threw another parade, getting me out of town. And that's the way it works. I was fortunate. I ended up in Texas with Ron Washington and John Daniels. Ron Washington was my coach for the 2 years I was in AAA, one of the years I was in AAA in the Mets organization. That's how far back our relationship goes, over 30 years. And he brought me on as a hitting coach, which would be my passion. I had been a hitting coach for 5 years in the major leagues and three years as a hitting coordinator in the minor leagues. And not only did Josh Hamilton have his best year, there's no doubt, his best year in the major leagues, it's one of the best years anybody's ever had in the major leagues, if you'll table his numbers. And the fact that if you would look and do a deeper dive, look what his numbers were after the first 2 months of the season and what they were the rest of the season. We realigned his entire batting mechanics, his swing. Not so much his swing, but his stance. He was a big toe tap guy, always had been. Toe tap, little leg kick. Took it all the way on June 1st in Chicago before a game. We worked 2 hours in the tunnels underneath. We went out, hit on the field. First game, he's going no toe tap, no leg kick. In the first 2-3 at-bats, it doesn't go well. I think Burley's on the mound. It's a bases loaded. It's a pop-up in the infield. It's first and second. It's a ground ball double play. And then another time he doesn't score around third. And he gets very frustrated. And I can hear him down at the end of the dugout next to Johnny Nairn, who was the assistant hitting coach. He said, "You tell that old man I'm not doing this anymore." And Johnny said, "You go down and tell the old man that's just 5 hours of work into this with you that you're canned after 3 at-bats. He comes walking by me, mumbling, goes down in the tunnel. I can hear some banging around. I'm thinking he's going to come up and tell me I'm done. He doesn't say anything, goes back out in the outfield, comes back in. And I think his next 3 at-bats, he hit a homer or two and a double, drove in 4 or 5 runs. He ended up the month of June with 49 hits.
Wow.
49 hits. And obviously the other numbers that he put up, the first 2 months, they were pedestrian numbers. It was like 24 RBIs and 5 homers in 2 months. And all the heavy lifting was done, you know, the last 4 months of the season and the playoffs, the World Series, an incredible year by another incredibly gifted player that worked hard to improve. And I don't know of another player I've ever had that made that much of a swing adjustment in season and ended up with success.
Mm. You know, you also had another special player when you managed in Pittsburgh, and that's Andrew McCutchen. And I got to say, what, PNC Park in Pittsburgh now? It is a beautiful park. That's my favorite out-of-town park. It's just beautiful. And you were very successful at also bringing them to the playoffs after missing it for a generation.
The best compliment I can pay Andrew at the time, and somebody was asking, you know, they keep asking, you know, what's the player like? I said, you see the player. The player's really gifted. Player works hard. Player's a good teammate. He shows up early. He stays late. He pays attention. He's always learning. I said, he's just that good off the field. And the best compliment I could pay him was that I'd hit him third and let him date my daughter. Mm. I mean, that's how much I thought of the guy. And I still stay in conversation with Andrew today. He's a very special person to our family. I've watched him go from boyfriend, girlfriend to his wife. Now they got 3 kids. I've seen that whole transformation. He has a tremendous sense of humor, and he's a very funny man. I can remember one time when 2013, the big year that we had when we busted the 20 consecutive losing season streak, 21 years without a playoff appearance. We took care of all that, but it was after the season was over and he was downtown and he still had the dreadlocks. He goes, "I think I finally arrived in Pittsburgh because they're not calling me Larry Fitzgerald anymore."
And by the way, I'm glad he's back in Pittsburgh for his last couple of years, because that's, you know, that's the place where he belongs.
It's a very good story. It's a very good, you know, segue for him to be in right now, because you don't talk about ending with him. He still thinks he's going to play. I don't know how long, but he's still playing.
You know, on your Wikipedia page, I was looking there, and there's a little link to something called St. Lucie Legends. And I saw your name on the roster. So you played in the Senior Baseball League? How was that?
How many listeners do you have? Any idea? The biggest disappointment for me, and it wasn't for everybody, it just did not work out well for me. I ended up playing senior baseball, and I went in under the nomer. I was a catcher. I had caught enough in the big leagues that I could go in, so you could play at 30 as a catcher. 35 was the, you know, the youngest age everybody else could go in. There were so many laughs, but the league in and of itself, it was almost, you know how you play slow break basketball? More often than not, most of us were playing slow break baseball, which just isn't pretty on a baseball field. But there were some gifted teams. There were some gifted players. I mean, at one point in time in the season there in St. Lucie, we traded managers. We traded our manager, Craig Nettles, to someplace else for Bobby Bonds. Bobby Bonds came over as our manager. I caught Vita Blue, though, in the senior league.
There you go.
One of my playing the Fangs.
Bloomberg?
The guys that were there, we made the most of it. A lot of us had a lot more fun than we played well. But some guys, like Ron Washington, was the MVP of the league the first year. He was in shape. He was tearing it up. And some of the pitchers, they can still pitch. There's no doubt about it. So it just didn't have the legs I think everybody thought it was going to have.
You know, speaking of 35 and older, I had the opportunity to go to Mets Fancy Camp in 2021. And your locker was right next to mine. And for some reason, you couldn't make it. But the thrill of playing, and do you still participate in those fantasy camps?
You know, I haven't been back to the Mets. The dates haven't lined up. But I got COVID that year. That's the only reason I didn't come.
Doug Pickey
invited me, and I had COVID. So I didn't go. But I've gone since I've been back. I used to work not just the Mets fantasy camp with Buddy Harrelson. God rest his soul. Yes. And Steve Zabriskie. But I worked the Cardinals. I worked the Royals. I eventually became a commissioner of the one man who had like eight teams.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked the Phillies camp. I worked a bunch of different camps. So fantasy camp baseball was a way of life for me in the offseason. I go back to the Rockies camp now. I don't play. I don't put on the uniform anymore. But I still get such a blast out of watching men like yourself, Jeff, go out and play with that passion, to play with that desire, to have the fun you have. It's good for my heart to watch people enjoy the game as much as I did.
Clint, you go to Texas now. You had a job that there's 30 managerial jobs. So that is when they write about jobs that are on the upswing, baseball manager isn't listed. But we don't get to speak to a lot of managers. But what is the interview process like when you're interviewing for manager? When you interviewed with Pittsburgh or the Mets, because you were interviewed for both, what kind of questions do they ask you? And just take us a little inside of that, please.
Well, yeah, I think it all depends on who's doing the interviewing. Obviously, with New York Mets, Sandy Alderson was running the interview. I mean, you got a Harvard grad who was a Marine. You don't get much more qualified, at least where I would think, to be interviewed by somebody that's got both those experiences. I think that they ask you about what you believe in, what's important to you in the game of baseball. What do you think your strengths are? What do you think maybe the areas that you would need to find good coaches to supplement you? What do you know about the fan base? What do you know about the history? I had done all my research. I had already spent 9 years with the Mets as a player and as a minor league manager when I went back. The passion was real. Bullpen usage. You know, do you believe, what are your thoughts on putting together your roster? What's your hitting philosophy? You said I was a hitting coach. You know, what was my hitting philosophy? What kind of offense would I try and help create? What were you looking in your coaching staff? How hands are with you? How much would you be inclined to reach out and bring other people in? Like when the scouts are on the road, I was always telling them, our clubhouse was inclusive. If you were an employee of the New York Mets organization or the Colorado Rockies organization or the Pittsburgh Pirates, you're welcome in our clubhouse. Just call me ahead of time. Let me know. I'll bring you on in. I want people to see our people. I want our players to see the other people that are out working to make the team better. I really believe this, most of their homework's done before the interview because they're calling former employers. They're calling people within the game that they've got connections with. They're calling to find out any red flags. that you may have, past, you know, background. They do the background check. They do all those different things. At the end of the day, though, it comes down about baseball, being passionate, what you represent. I always would share with them the name on the front means something to me. I'm a firm believer in wherever I worked, I lived there. I lived in Pittsburgh. I lived in Texas. I lived in Colorado. What better way to at least try and influence free agents? Well, Pittsburgh's a great place. Come here. Well, where do you live in the winter? Well, I live in Florida in the winter. But Pittsburgh's a really nice place to be. I became part of the community as well as being the manager. My kids went to school. We became involved in other facets of the community. We did that in Pittsburgh. We did it in Colorado. Plus, you know, the nuances of a city. When I was with the Mets, I lived out in Long Island. We got the train to take us in and stop us where it didn't stop for anybody else. You learn the LIE is the world's largest parking lot. You can give players tips on when to drive and when not to drive. You learn your way around. You know, you become an ally of the city. We still go back to this day, my best memories in New York. We love New York City still to this day. We go back every year, my family and I spend 4 to 5 days a week or two before Christmas. We go to the Rockettes. We usually go see a musical or two. We window shop. We dine. We experience all of it. We go down to Rockefeller Center. It's the most beautiful city in the world at Christmas. We see the big tree. This year, we even bucket list the thing. We stayed at the Plaza. Mm. Come on. It doesn't get any better than that.
Doesn't.
New York City is an incredible place. So then I had to try and make Pittsburgh sound like an incredible place. And you can. You know, you look at the North Shore, you talk about the ballpark, you talk about the bridges, you talk about the confluence of the rivers, you talk about the history of the other sports teams there. The only sports city in America that all teams wear the same colors, black and gold.
Mm-hmm.
There's different things to pick up on. Colorado, you know, we're the one team that really hasn't carried its own weight. The Avalanche have, you know, they have their cup. The NBA team raised their thing. The Broncos have won in the past. The Rockies still haven't. How do we supplement that? How do we make that happen? But it's just identifying with, becoming a part of, and letting your employers know that that's part of your, you know, your mission while you're there. Family oriented. You know, I like having the kids around. There were times, there was boundaries. It wasn't all kids 24 hours, but I liked having, what better memories for some of my players? And Matt Holliday had his kid Jackson in the clubhouse when he was 3 years old in Colorado. You know, it doesn't play out like that for every father and son, but it's played out pretty well for the holidays. So all those special things, whether it's a wives trip, a road trip, we used to have father's trips in Colorado and Pittsburgh. We'd take our dads to a one city trip, 4 games. And it was almost like reverse little league because the players would spend the 4 days picking up after their dads. We'd bring them out on the field early. We'd do all those things. So a lot of different ways to incorporate vision, balance, family, fun. But also to bring a winning brand to your team, to make that Mets or that Rockies logo on the front mean something special to the people that are wearing the uniforms and for the people that are working inside the ballpark.
Clint, this has been an incredible. We really appreciate your time. One last question, and you've been very open on social now. You're on social media. Your X handle is Clint Hurdle 13. And I came across something that you are hosting a 10th annual hot stove dinner on March 23rd in Florida. Could you tell us what this fundraiser is about and how anybody can contribute?
Well, it's very near and dear to our heart. We've been holding this. We started in Colorado. Our daughter Maddie was born with a birth defect, Prader-Willi syndrome. That's a deletion of the 15th chromosome. And to give you just some short cliff notes, the 15th chromosome is your chromosome. It's your satiation chromosome. It's the one that lets you know you're hungry. It's the one that also lets you know you're full. Our kid's chromosome was blown up at conception. So forever, from the time they wake up to go to bed, they're hungry. Some of them are ravenously hungry. So that complicates a lot of different things on the spectrum. Anxiety, attention span. There's parts of Maddie's now 21. We've been holding this hot stove fundraiser in Bradenton or Anna Marie Island for the last 10 years. And it's the biggest fundraising effort that Prader-Willi syndrome has because not many people still know about it. The awareness is critical. We've raised probably the last 3 or 4 years over $200,000, close to $250,000 each year.
Mm-hmm.
One-time event in the season. We have an auction, silent, live, dinner, MC. We've brought their two guys from Pittsburgh. And Joe Klimchicks will be our MC. We've had some notable people show up in the past. But for anybody that want to donate, I mean, the best way is to get in touch with me. And I gave you my social media card. I don't know if at some point you can put that up or post it on your website.
Definitely will.
But clinthurdle.com is an email address that I use. And I also use that for my encouragement emails that I send out every day. They're free. One's faith-based, one's encouragement leadership-based. But if you'd like to make a donation, that is the best place to go. And I can get you the link and connect you. No donation we would turn away. We can have a virtual link where you can watch the actual event live. You can watch it from your home in New York. Mm-hmm. You can watch it from your home in Pittsburgh. We still get big draws from people back in the burg, people in Colorado that can't make it. And obviously we're here. We do anywhere from 200 to 225 people each time we have the event, which is pretty significant. We have a helicopter drop, golf balls, a long putting contest. We just have a fun night. And it's the one night a year where our daughter Maddie was never asked out on a date. She never went to prom. Mm. She'll never drive a car. She'll probably never live on her own. But this night is like her prom every year, once a year. She gets dressed up and she is her best version of herself that night. And the MC, Joe Klimchek, has a way with her up front in front of the people. And usually a few of her friends with Prader-Willi syndrome show up and the parents get together. So there's just wins all over the place for everybody. Tremendous food, fun, band, all of it. But clinthurdle.com, if you'll just tap that in, put that in your link, and it'll take you to my website. And just send me a message, and we'll go from there.
Okay, this is definitely. It's very important. Anybody wants to contribute, please. Very, very worthy cause. Clint, I never heard of Prader-Willi syndrome before, so I'm glad for the education. And I wish you the best of success and having a very big fundraiser. Clint, thank you very much for being on Baseball and BBQ. We really appreciate your time.
Well, Leonard, Jeff, thank you for having me. Thank you for your patience on me getting on here. And I really appreciate the fact that you brought up the fundraiser, because if you know, you know. And being a father of a child with special needs, I know there's a lot of us out there. I really appreciate your thoughtfulness and your awareness. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Clint. We appreciate it.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue, you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you very much, Clint. You know, Jeff, I hope people will also donate and possibly attend that charitable function that, you know, that Clint talked about.
Absolutely. Worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Clint. We really appreciate it. I want to thank our next guest with his pet peeve, and that is Anthony Marasco. And it's a good one.
Hey, Len and Jeff. This is Anthony Marasco of the Beltway Mets calling to relate a pet peeve that I have, or is it more of a rant? Maybe it's a grieve, combine the two phrases together. Anyway, my rant is about those folks who are advocates to get Pete Rose into the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. His records are noted. They have memorabilia there, and all his accomplishments are there. So he is, in effect, in the Hall of Fame. However, he is not in the plaque gallery, and in my humble opinion, And Jeff Cohen, I'm sure, will agree with me, he does not deserve to be long in the Hall of Fame because he broke the rules. So that is my pet peeve. Pete Rose is in the Hall of Fame, and it's worth a visit up to Cooperstown to visit the museum and to see all the wonderful things that are on display. Love your show. Hope everything's going well. And let's go Mets.
Thank you very much, Anthony. You know, Anthony, you know what you won't get upset with? BaseballBBQ.com. You cannot go to baseballbbq.com and have a pet peeve with them. Grilling tools and accessories, baseball bat handles. You're going to be happy. Go to baseballbbq.com. Grilling season is coming. Jeff, you know who else is coming?
Who's that?
Well, it's more like, what's that? Because, you know, we have a special for our listeners that we have every week.
Yes. And that is a
baseball quote of the week.
Baseball is a kid's game that grown-ups only tend to screw up. It's Bob Lemon.
Wow. Truer things said. That's a good quote, Jeff.
Yeah.
That really is. And we keep giving. We give the quote, and now we're giving everyone an awesome interview with Matt Deaton and Ray Sheehan. We'll see you soon. Baseball and Barbecue listeners, you guys are in for a treat. This is a big one. We have with us a pitmaster. His journey to becoming a professional pitmaster and chef is rooted in a passion for food that is instilled in him by his mother's cooking from scratch and his exposure to many regional styles in his travels as a child in a military background. That's intriguing enough. And, you know, I'm not even going to go further with that because sometimes I reveal too much in the intro. So we're gonna leave it at that. But we are going to say one thing. We have a special guest co-host with us, and that's Ray Sheehan. And Matt, our guest, by the way, is Matt Deaton. And Matt was nice enough to put a blurb in Ray's book, his award-winning Sauces and Rubs book. This is what our guest, Matt Deaton, said about our guest co-host's book. Ray is a talented chef and an aficionado of barbecue. He is dedicated to his craft and only delivers the best. And that is Matt Deaton, pitmaster chef at Food E Restaurant. So that's big praise coming from our guest. So Matt, without further ado, we want to welcome you to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we like to let our guest co-host lead off. As we say, now batting number one, Ray Sheehan. Go ahead, Ray.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. Love Matt. Matt is one of the most talented people I know. And so when it came time to ask people for, to write something for my book, he was one of the first people that I asked, and he graciously accepted. You know, full disclosure, we've known each other for a long time and kind of got into the barbecue scene of competition anyway, around the same time, and became fast friends and had a great time doing it. And since those days, years ago, Matt has become one of the premier pitmasters in the Mid-Atlantic region. And I got to ask Matt, as batting leadoff, the first question I have to ask you is, I mean, I may know it, but I want our listeners to find out so much more about you. How and why did you get into barbecue? You know, what made you fall in love with barbecue?
Oh man, I mean, that's like deep. I mean, really, when I was growing up, I guess my first real exposure to it is an uncle of mine had a pig farm in central Illinois. And a couple times a year, we would go down to his house. We would go pick out a pig, and then we'd slaughter the pig. And that was, I guess, my first real hardcore exposure to doing that. But my dad, we barbecued what people call barbecue. You know, we grilled out like every weekend, right? But we call it barbecue, right? But we moved around a lot. My dad was in the Air Force. So we lived in Arkansas. We lived in Alabama. Lived in Mississippi, North Carolina, California, twice, Illinois, and a couple other places. So we always try to find the best barbecue in the area. Like, we would hunt it down. That's kind of where my love for it started, barbecue specific. My mom grew up in a family of 13. They cooked everything at home and out of their own garden. And so that's pretty much how I learned to cook. My mom would have us in the kitchen or out on the grill with my dad. It took me a while to realize that I really just wanted to cook.
Matt, you actually were in a corporate job. You left a very good corporate job to pursue.
Very lucrative corporate job, yes.
To follow your passion. So
yeah.
What were you doing? What was the corporate job?
I had a real estate company and team that we spanned three states and sold a lot of homes and dealt with a lot of banks, and it was a great moneymaker. It was not a great lifestyle. I did it for the money, you know? There was mm-hmm. no passion there. One day, he looked at my wife, and I was just like, because we did it together. We both just decided to, like, let's just not do this anymore. I said, hey, you think I could get a job cooking? And she was like, are you kidding me? You know, and I took a job, and I made, like, $15 an hour, in my mid-30s. And that was just, like, that's scary. We were lucky that, you know, with our past job that we were able to fund our way through that for a while.
So it's got to be a lot more fun being a pitmaster than a real estate agent, or not just an agent, but you said you had a team. Yeah. It's got to be a lot more fun cooking, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, some days can be really tough, you know, and hard to call them fun when it's pouring rain or bitter cold or whatever. But overall, it's way more fun. Yeah. Way more fun. It's passionate, super passionate.
Yeah. And I got to ask you, you said you started out with your uncle's farm, a pig farmer, and you slaughtered a pig and you mm-hmm. cooked the pig. Most people mm-hmm. start off grilling burgers. You started off with a whole hog.
Right. I mean, my parents, both my parents, they grew up in this super small. My mom's like graduating high school class was like 12. And my dad was like 100, right? They were the first kids in their families to graduate from college. You know, they were the first kids to get actually out of small town America. And my mom never wanted to look back. But we would always go back. When she had all of her siblings had at least five kids, you know, you go 12 other families with five kids or more, there are big parties. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to slaughter a whole pig or two sure. to feed everybody.
You know, talking about whole hog, that's something that's like the holy grail for so many people that they're, you know, when you ask them, what's something that you haven't done in barbecue that you want to do is to cook the whole hog. But not only did you start out cooking the whole hog, but you worked for Sam Jones Barbecue doing mm-hmm. whole hogs. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about the holy grail. I mean, that's a twofer there.
I guess.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I knew that I needed to do that. And I saw an opportunity because they were looking, they were getting ready. They just opened up Sam Jones Barbecue in Winterville, which is only about 10 minutes from Aiden, which is where, the Skylight Inn is. Sam Jones' grandfather started Skylight Inn, which is the oldest operating pits in North Carolina, eastern side. And that's all we did was whole hog. And I saw an opportunity and I knew that I needed to do that, or at least try to do that. So I did. And again, I had another conversation with my wife and went down there, got an Airbnb for like 6 months straight and just did whole hog every day, thousand hogs. It's a real culture down there. It's very different than what I think most Americans think of as in barbecue. It is really, really part of the culture, at least in the eastern side of North Carolina. Like after church gets out, that's like one of the biggest days, Sunday. Is like one of the biggest days for that business because everybody gets out of church and they all meet at either at Sam Jones or at Skylight Inn or at Bee's Barbecue down, you know, not too far away, or Grady's Barbecue. And there's like 100 more, but those are like my favorite, the ones I just named. But it's a real culture. So like we're producing a lot of pig, like cooking a lot of pig. Which never would, I could not see it happening up north. Everybody tries it and they're never successful at it because it's just not sustainable because the demand is just not there because people haven't been brought up in it. But down there, it's the real deal. And it's no joke. They take their craft very seriously. And I was blessed to be part of that.
Matt, what does this mean to you? Because I saw this when I was doing some research. Need to respect the relationship between the earth, animals, farmers, and chefs. That's something you believe strongly in. What is that? Tell us about that.
Our food, you know, we need to respect the food that we have, and the farmers that take their hard work and labor to produce that food, whether it be a pig or a carrot. We can bring all of it together with a chef that respects all that. You know, it can really, really just come and mesh together and be a really pure thing. It's more than just like these big monster farms that are owned by corporations. You know, our small local farms, that animal is giving its life for our sustenance. So we need to respect that. So we try to use as much as we can, waste as little as we can, and do it honor. So try to cook the best that we can every time. That will, like, it'll bring, you know, more patrons, I hope, into my restaurant. And it just honors everybody's work and everybody's sacrifice to get that food on our table. I don't think a lot of Americans know how the food chain really works in the United States, but we really, really need to be respectful of those animals. Their lives too. The farmers, boy, they work really, really hard and they don't make a whole lot of money. So we need to support them as much as we can and respect the work that they do.
Matt, your barbecue is different than what people might typically associate with barbecue. Tell us what the difference in your style of cooking is compared to what we all think of as, you know, our everyday barbecue.
I hate putting a label on. Of course, you got like the bangers, you know, you've got Carolina style and you've got Texas and you've got Kansas City. Really, I look at smoke as an ingredient when I cook. I believe that it needs to be used with precision and not just let it, like, the smoke roll. You know, I've never found it enjoyable to eat a pork shoulder or any piece of meat that has been smoked for 87 hours. That's all you taste is a smoke. I really, really want you to taste that meat or that vegetable or whatever, because, I mean, that's the most expensive thing on the plate. You know, if we're going to cook a steak, I want you to taste that really, really great meat. So I'm going to give you the best meat that's out there. So we're going to treat it like an ingredient more so than just smoked. So I don't like making every product on my menu a smoked product. You see that in a lot of restaurants, smoked mac and cheese, smoked baked beans, smoked everything, you know, and then it's a little much. You know, if we treat it like an ingredient, we treat it with respect. I think it's got a little bit more style.
Are you involved with a restaurant now?
I'm kind of in between a little bit, but I've been working with this, the oldest operating barbecue pits here in Virginia. We cook Virginia style, which is very similar to North Carolina style, which is very similar to South Carolina style. Let's call it Eastern style. I truly believe that barbecue originated in Virginia. And my only reasoning for that is that the first African Americans were brought here to Virginia. And I try to give them as much respect and honor as I possibly can. I don't know where I was going with that now.
I was asking you about if you're involved in restaurants, and you said you're in between.
Right, yeah. So I've been working with this restaurant. The name of the restaurant's Almonds. They've been around since 1954. The Almonds family got out of the business in about 1984 and sold to another family in Fredericksburg, Virginia. But the family that bought the company, they're not chefs, they're not cooks. They just wanted to preserve something from the past, keep it alive in Fredericksburg. So after quite a few years and a lot of the staff that was originally there aren't there anymore. There were no original recipes except for a couple things. When I say a couple things, I mean a sauce recipe and a coleslaw recipe. Outside of that, nothing remains. So eventually they just had a couple cooks. When I got there, they were either making frozen mac and cheese or canned collards. You know, everything was pretty much kind of just taken from one carton, heated up, and shipped out the door. No smoking anymore. They hadn't smoked meat in quite a few years. So I brought all that back, everything homemade, down to the pickles. We've had a lot of really great success, like a lot of really great success. Been very happy. Washington Post talked about us. Southern Living's talked about us. Many, many barbecue icons have been through our doors, and a lot of patrons and a lot of great reviews. And I love my city because they've been giving us a lot of great support.
When you talk about your restaurant and your passion for barbecue really shines through, and I have to ask, A, what are you cooking on? What's your cooker at the restaurant? Okay. And tell us more about this Virginia style that is, you know, turning heads and making everyone hungry.
Cooking on a Lang, two Langs, which is a Georgia built cooker. It's a reverse flow cooker, but I think I can cook on just about anything. Yeah.
You're cooking with wood. You're cooking
with wood. But I'm cooking with all wood. Yeah. 100%. So we get mostly oak and hickory because that's just what grows here. White oak, red oak at times, and hickory. And I do love my hickory.
And Virginia style barbecue, when you say that it was barbecue is pretty much, that's the birthplace of barbecue in the United States. But what separates Virginia barbecue from other regions? How, if you were to describe it, you know, what?
We use whole shoulder skin on. We do a vinegar-based sauce, but our vinegar-based sauce has been around since 1954. And I know of the last restaurant that just closed before us. They have been around since the 30s, and they were doing a very, very similar sauce that we're doing. I mean, it's all in the nuances to define the differences, like between us and North Carolina and South Carolina. Eastern side, western side of Carolina gets totally different, but wonderful and beautiful. And I love Western style also. And, you know, we, like our sauce has a little bit of clove in it, which you're not used to tasting, and a couple other spices that are a bit different, but equally delicious.
So Matt, we kind of glossed over. We went from you're cooking, you're moving around a lot because your dad was in the Air Force. But the one constant seems to be that you cooked barbecue with your dad.
Yeah.
Wonderful thing. And then you have a corporate job, which it definitely sounds like it's good that you got out of there.
Heck yeah.
Your philosophy. But you have a corporate job. You end up, you have a skill. You love, you have a passion. So you start cooking. And then we went all the way to now.
Sure. But so the in between there.
Yeah, what's going on in between?
The in between there is like a lot of me cooking at home and stuff and just playing around with Weber bullets. Got a couple of those, the WSM 22s, you name the ECBs, all the different like small, cheap, you know, El Cheapo Brinkman, you know, the ECB, the worst cooker in the world, but learning to cook on it is, if you can cook on that, you can cook on anything. I hooked up with this guy that, because I was in all these barbecue groups on, I was just like kind of Facebook, and a couple of like Barbecue Brethren was another one of the message boards, and hooked up with this guy that me and Ray had both kind of hooked up together. And we went on we joined this team, a lot of drama and stupid stuff, but so it was our first professional team for both of us, and we worked together. We became very fast friends. Like, he's a brother from another mother for me. Like, I would do anything for Ray.
Likewise.
Like, anything. So that was it. We started doing that. And then Ray kind of, we both, once this team crashed and burned, Ray started his own team. So we did that. And I started really thinking about, like, hey, look, I really like this competition stuff, but I don't think that I could ever really feed this competition food to my family or to other people. Seemed to me that it lost the spirit of, I don't know, for me, barbecue is like this, like, group experience where you, like, all hug together, you know, and celebrate competition barbecue. Now, I know a lot of people love it, and I zero ill will, and I think some of the things that they do are amazing. But for me personally, I was like, I can't feed this food when I'm, like, pumping nitrates into it. And I'm making it look like this perfect, perfect, perfect picture of what some guy in Kansas City thinks that barbecue should be, when the regions are so different. It just wasn't my style. So I wanted to make food that people in mass could eat. So then I took a job where I had to just wreck my body and wreck myself in a kitchen for a couple of years, and then really, really, like, learn how to work in a professional kitchen and then work on my craft at the same time.
Matt, could you tell us about your association with Wildwood Grilling?
Oh, yeah. They're a company out of Idaho, and they make a lot of wood things. And one of their derivatives from the things that they make out of wood is, like, grilling planks and all the little things that you use to smoke with. You know, if it could be pellets, it could be chunks. But really, really great group of people there. And they make a really, really wonderful product. And so they just, you know, so that they would just sponsor me. We've done that now for, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years.
You know, I love what you said about Ray. That was a beautiful thing. And you cooked barbecue together, and you formed a terrific bond. Yeah.
It's a part to, like, I was in the military for a short while. And it's very similar to that relationship that you have that with the guy that you're working with 24/7. It's real. And it's pretty great. Ray's a great guy.
I mean, I'm very fortunate.
He's a great guy.
I'm here. I'm <not dead. laughs> But I feel the same way. I mean,
and goddamn, you know, he makes beautiful sauces. Oh my God. My wife's favorite sauce is not mine. It's not mine. It's Ray's.
Well, we're working on that. So thank you.
It's Ray's. It's been Ray's for a long time.
Is it the Memphis Ray's Mop or the other?
Yeah, the Memphis Mop.
The Memphis Mop. Yeah,
the OG. That is,
that's the OG. Yeah.
Yeah.
Leaves that little bit of spice lingering on your palate. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty wonderful.
So that's a huge compliment coming from Matt, guys, because Matt has worked with some of the best people in the industry to make himself better, because he's, like, one of those people that's, like, a lifelong learner. I have to ask Matt, you know, what of the chefs that you worked with, and I know, you know, you gain, like, insight from a little bit here, a little bit there from different chefs, but is there maybe one chef that you worked with, or even someone that you have yet to work with, that has really influenced your style? Like, not I mean, cooking, like sides, everything, not just.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Side. Yeah. Yeah. It's easy. That's easy. Joy Crump, Chef Joy Crump. She was nominated for a James Beard Award last year. She's a James Beard Boot Camp for chefs. I got to do that a couple years ago. That's probably the most amazing experience, is working with James Beard. Yeah.
And Chef where Joy. Was that? Where did you go?
That was here in that? Fredericksburg.
Oh, yep. Okay.
She moved from Atlanta, Georgia up here and opened a restaurant called Foodie, which is a Southern style bistro kind of restaurant. Really relaxed and chill. She opened my eyes to, she would ask me, you know, hey, can you smoke this cream? You know, can you smoke this butter? Can you smoke you know, what can you smoke, you know? And so we just started like doing all kinds of things. We were always smoking olives. I made smoked ice, smoked almonds, smoked, you name it, we've done it.
So we that got goes a chance back to using the smoke as an ingredient.
Correct. As opposed to just like we would smoke ingredients right. that are in larger dishes, as opposed to smoking the whole dish.
Yes.
You know?
Okay.
So then you can measure what you're making. I make my own smoked paprika now. I make my own smoked salt now. You name it, we figured out a way to kind of work it in. We make smoked ice cream.
So not only a pit master, but you're more of evolved into a culinarian. Coming from a corporate world, you've made your way and more, like I said, more of a culinarian, and you just happen to be a award-winning pitmaster.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, you're very humble, but I mean, everyone from, like you said, Southern Living to Washington Post, to Daniel Vaughn, you know, I mean, has been through your doors and had your food. And what would you say your most requested side dish is?
Collards. I think my collard greens. Yeah. For they're vegetarian, which everybody like freaks out about. Like, how can you make collards vegetarian? But I wanted to, when I developed my last menu, I wanted to make it so even a vegetarian could come to my restaurant and enjoy the food. So all of our sides minus one are all vegetarian, and if not vegan, it made sense. So I just had to figure out how do I reinforce, put more flavor into the collards that you would get from like ham hocks or whatever that people typically do. And I was not a person that was brought up on collards. It wasn't a thing, but I certainly do love them a lot.
Matt, when Ray told us about you and we reached out, your response was, I'd love it. Bonus points for baseball as I love the game. Yeah. So let's talk some baseball. Sweet. You told us before we came on that you are a lifetime Chicago Cubs fan.
Yeah, hardcore.
Yeah.
My dad grew up in Southern Illinois, played baseball. He was played like Legion ball and then single A ball for the Cardinals before he had to go to the Vietnam. He loved the game. And so we didn't have a choice but to love the game, because even if we didn't, we were still going to play it. You know, it's amazing how complex that game is. You know, people don't really, I guess if you don't love the game, you don't realize how difficult it is to play that game. Yeah. And I could never play the game at that level. But I sure do love to watch it. And I love to.
You know, Matt, you're a Cubs fan now. Did it ever come into your thinking that you could go your whole lifetime, as many did before, without seeing the Cubs win a World Series?
I never thought it was going to happen. I started going to Cubs games in 1979. It was a long time. It's a long time. My dad, of course, again, he was a Cardinals fan.
Right.
But we were living in Chicago. So like all his buddies were Cubs fans. And a friend of his had a bar down in Wrigleyville before it got like, it was before Wrigleyville was like what it is today. Today, Wrigleyville is like, you know, upscale and posh. When I was growing up, it was kind of a dumpster fire, but you loved it. You loved it. And all those guys in the bars, I had a Cardinals hat on. And the guy that owned the bar came to me and he gave me, put a Cubs hat on me and said, you won't wear that hat in this bar. And that's when, you know, dads can take kids into a bar. That's not happening today.
The Cardinals, yeah. The Dirty Birds.
Yeah, but they got a lot of wins. Got a lot of those.
Yeah.
Got a lot of wins.
A lot of wins, championships. Yeah, they are. Yeah. Besides the Yankees, they're probably... Jeff, are they probably the second?
Yes, I think they're second, yes.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
And they got a cool uniform. Their uniform's great.
Yeah, they do. And a great history as well. I know Len likes telling the story that Len and I was on, we got press passes, and it was the Mets versus the Cubs, and we were on the field, and we talked to David Ross before the game, and we asked him about barbecue question. He had no idea that, you know, these two guys were going to ask about barbecue question. So he asked him his favorite barbecue joint in Chicago. And I think he said smoked.
Smoked, yeah.
Yeah.
He did a double take when we asked him that. He was looking. We said, we'd like to ask you a question. He's looking at the press pass. But when he was expecting something baseball related, obviously. Wow.
I got lucky when I went to college in Daytona Beach. We had the Daytona Beach Cubs there. So that was great. And then every spring training season, my brother would fly down to Daytona and we would go for, like the whole of spring break and see how many games we could see, you know, so we would trollop all over Central Florida, catch six innings here, catch five innings there, roll around. That was the best. That was the best.
Do you have a favorite Cub that you followed?
That I follow? Favorite Cub that I followed? There's a lot of great Cubs out there.
Mark Grace was a great player on the Cubs back in the
day. He was amazing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say there's not one Cub that I follow.
Yeah. I know Ryan Sandberg was a very popular guy too, Hall of Famer.
He was super, he was great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ernie Banks.
Well, it was legend. After Matt. That was before Matt's time.
I know, but I'm sure he knows who he is.
Legend.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Mr. Cub. Isn't he Mr. Cub?
Yeah. Seventh inning stretch was always fun there. See how drunk everybody would get.
Did you ever sit, where is it, the bleacher bums or where they yell throw if somebody catches a
We
a
sat in the bleachers a lot because the tickets were like $5, you know, $6 mm-hmm. to go sit in the bleachers. A couple games, I remember my dad got us like on the first baseline or the third baseline, but typically we were out in the bleachers because that was it. You know, they were uncomfortable, but we didn't care. We were kids. We'd run around, watch the game, run around some more, watch Harry Carey get wasted. He would be drunk. So, yeah, worlds of entertainment going to a Cubs game, even if we lost. And I remember going to Cubs games before they had lights.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a huge deal when they didn't have lights. Yeah. When they got lights, it was a huge deal.
Sure.
Yeah.
And now there was a lot of
they didn't want that. They did. There was a lot of people.
A lot of pushback.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, all those rooftop houses, you know, now they're all owned, corporate owned, where people sit on their own little bleachers, you know, looking over center field. It's pretty amazing how much everything's changed, but I still love the Cubs.
Matt, as the guest co-host, I am the opener and I am the closer.
The Mariano of the podcast.
But I do have, two quick questions for you. You know, I know you don't do a lot of competition barbecue, but you've certainly done a lot of cultural food events, Charleston Wine and Food Fest, Boucheries down in Georgia, Pig Island. But when you did Pig Island, you know, you were cooking whole hog. Mm-hmm. You recruited an all-star team of people to come and cook.
And a couple from Chicago, too.
And you brought cinder blocks and built a pit. And tell them what you did. And you won this great big award there and cooked up the most amazing whole hog.
Yeah, so a friend of mine, his name is John Jackson. He runs a farm. He's a retired Army Ranger, and he came back to PTSD pretty good. Had a bunch of his brethren that had PTSD. Before he went into the Rangers, he was a geneticist. And 9/11 happened, and he's like, I'm going to join the military right now. I'm going to become a Ranger and I'm going to go stop these people from attacking our country. but he came back with a lot of problems, and he had a lot of brothers that had problems. So he created this farm. He's a super smart dude. Created this farm so he could help other military guys find not only a new job or career in farming, which is needed. We need new farmers, but to also give them a way to work through their PTSD. And he is raising these heritage hogs that are amazing. And he brought me what's called a Piedmont Black, which is like a big black, a heritage breed pig, has really long black hair. They're beautiful. Their meat is as red as steak, as beef. So he brought me one of those. And he asked me how big a pig you want. And I was like, looked at the number of people we were expecting. We're expecting like 800 to 1,000 for that event. And so I'm like, give me somewhere around 200 pounds. That'd be great. Maybe 220. Well, he brings me one that's 280 after it's been butchered, 280 pounds. And I'm like, man, this is a big, big, big pig. It took us 22 and a half hours to cook that pig. I pretty much ran it all night. A friend of mine came in from Chicago, flew in just to help me set up my cinder block pit and get everything squared away. And then he jumped on a plane and had to fly out. And John Jackson, and I got a couple other chefs from North Carolina. And it was just like, it was an amazing, but we got that pig done in 22 and a half hours. Everybody else had their pigs on electric or gas-driven cookers, you know, and they just brought them in that day. We did win Best Dish. I won the Pitmaster Award. It was just fun to be there with my friends and to share the food. Yeah, share the food with all those people. And I got, you know, got to share with them. It was a Friends of Firefighters event. It was pretty cool because it was on the anniversary of 9/11, the 20th anniversary, you know, and they had the memorial was lit up, and it was like we could see it right from where we were. Stunning.
That's beautiful. And it's really a testament to your dedication building the pit and bringing in this heritage hog and really treating it with respect and knowing how to, you know, produce it for that many people. But the other follow-up question, and I'll leave you with this, but out of all the things that you've done, and we all contemplate, you know, next steps, but what in the barbecue world, you know, what brings you joy? You've worked in restaurant kitchens, you've been a pit master. What do you love about barbecue? What is it that brings you joy at this point in your career?
That's a really good question. I mean,
it's a really light question.
Yeah, I know. Yes. I know. I have to say, like, my team that works with me, I get a lot of joy working with these people. You know, I don't know if I know Ray has. I don't know if you guys have ever worked in professional kitchens, but it's like we're like the island of misfit toys, right? People from everywhere speaking all kinds of different languages. And somehow, some way, we can put it all together and put out food that people really, really like. And, you know, I see these people more often than my family sometimes. It's really working with those other chefs and those other cooks and the dishwasher. And I really like cherish that almost more than anything else anymore these days. I love putting out great food. Don't get me wrong. I love hearing people say your food's great, you know, best food I've ever had, best barbecue I've ever had, whatever. But really, 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 I like it when I'm either feeding or working with the people that are in our industry the most, I think. I really like that a lot. It's like another family, you know, it's that I like that the most. And now my wife's working with me too all the time, so it's even better. I bet you most people can't say that, but I really, really like with my wife every day. I really like working with her every day.
Matt, we really enjoy you joining us on Baseball and BBQ. Do you have any social media that you want people to know that, where they can follow you?
I'm on Instagram, Pitmaster_Deaton. On Facebook, Matthew Deaton. That's about it. I don't do a ton of, I used to do a ton of social media. I just, I like, you know, running the restaurant, just like kind of like,
yeah,
I wish I had more time for it. Just gotcha. Don't have a ton of time for it.
So if anybody wants to follow Matthew, the places to go. Matthew, we really enjoyed you coming on Baseball and BBQ. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me.
Best of all, best in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ray. Wow. All right.
It's a lot of show, Len.
That's a lot of show. And it's a lot of show because we also gave you a bonus. Don't forget the bonus episode. But yeah, a lot of show. So, Jeff, how do we end? I'll tell you how we end. We are presented by Bet Online. It is where the game starts, but we are not starting. We're ending. So how do we end?
With the poet.
Shel Krakowski.
And the musician.
Dave Dresser.
And the song.
Baseball always brings you home.
And we'll see you next week on episode number 230.
Clap.